You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to Marcus Birdman, a brilliant comic. I describe him as a multimedia artist, I think, in the show notes of this episode. Recently he's been combining his very good, very solid club comedy. You know, this is really someone who could confidently headline any room in the world. But he's been combining that with drawing. He's a proper drawing artist. We don't often talk about artists on this program, at least as people being those who can actually draw. But he can, and also he has other kind of artistic concerns within stand-up itself. We stumble upon something which I'm very glad we did, about how he uses rhythm and meter and language in his jokes. He's someone who the jokes themselves become very scripted because he has to nail the same rhythm every time, because he wants to, because that's part of the architecture of the joke. So there's a really fascinating chat to be had about that. And we talk about his volatile relationship with his father, who is a priest, and with his father's God, who is God. Or isn't God, depending on your point of view. So we're going to get stuck right into that in just a moment. Quick reminder, both Marcus and myself will be at the Edinburgh Festival, so listen out or check the show notes for details of those shows. And if you would like to join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, like so many before you, then not only do you get access to the Slack workspace app that we can all chat to each other and gossip on, but you also get the private podcast, which has got episodes of a show where we critique other comics' work. Newer acts send in their stuff and we all cluster around it and give them our feedback. And also, of course, extras from any of the shows in the last 296 that have extras. This one does. There's 30 minutes of extras with Marcus, including talking about survivor's guilt after the stroke that he suffered, the shot at the top he might have missed, and whether or not you can fake greatness in comedy. Lots of excellent stuff there. ComediansComedian.com/insiders. Now, this is Marcus Birdman.
I mean, have you ever given up for any length of time?
6 days, 2 weeks ago. That's it. And that was because I realised that I hadn't gone a week without alcohol since I started drinking.
Yeah.
Since I was a teenager.
Well, I usually give up for Lent, which I did this year. And you feel fucking marvellous. But the trouble is, it's just so boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. And you feel so much better. But I'm so bored. Because it's such a social lubricant, you know. Like, it's like, and you just I just find in social situations, I just want to go home, because it's like there's only so many Coca-Colas you can have, and I feel like I need alcohol to, you know, I'm quite a reserved human being.
Yeah,
I need one or two.
Yeah, yeah.
To, and I'm not a bad drunk. Like, I'm kind of like, I think I'm quite sort of, it sort of brings me out of myself, not into a different human being.
Sure.
I think I'm better, I'm more me than I am sober.
Is that worrying? That for me is a red flag. I know exactly what you mean.
No, because like, you know, 4 or 5, then I'm more someone else. But, I find myself sort of like, I feel physically better, but I'm kind of grumpy. Like, yeah. I sort of go through that hangover. Oh God, it's like, isn't everything shit? Like, I don't feel like that. I just feel bored with existence.
Do you mean sober or hungover?
Yeah, sober. I'm like going, I feel physically so much better, but like, what's the point? You know, this is boring.
And is the month off every year, is that to reassure yourself you're not an alcoholic?
Yeah.
It is.
And to sort of clean up. But yeah, just to reassure. See, I've said too many times I don't have a problem with alcohol to sort of...
Yeah.
I don't think I haven't got a major problem with alcohol. But like many, many, you know, it's just the lifestyle we lead. It's like I don't have an addictive personality, so I don't have to watch it in that sense, you know. But it's just too easy to booze in this job, you know.
Do you enjoy the lifestyle of being a comedian?
Yeah, I love it.
Do you consider yourself a road comedian?
As defined by me, yes.
Nice.
So my definition is I think Tom Rhodes, who you all know,
yes.
I don't know if you've interviewed him,
not yet. No.
You know, superb human being and comedian. He describes himself as that road warrior, gunslinger, Shane kind of character, you know. And I sort of, so there's a romance of that, and I think I might affectatiously, if that's a word, adhere to that. I don't adhere to the drinking and shagging and boozing aspect of the road warrior. I've done that, but I don't want to glorify that. Yeah, that's not great behaviour. That's not behaviour that I would judge it on anyone, or indeed on myself. But like, I think my definition, yes, I'm a road comic.
Yes.
Perhaps someone else's slightly more pejorative definition of what a road comic might
be. You're leaning more to the poet end of the warrior.
Yeah,
poet.
The Jack Kerouac side of the road, rather than the face down in the gutter road, you know.
Yeah.
And that slightly laddie connotation of maybe what road warrior might be used as someone sort of using it as a bit with a bit pejoratively.
Sure, because you have the soul of an artist. You are an artist. You started off as an artist.
Yeah, yeah. Do I have this? I don't know. Yeah, I suppose so. I wonder what that means. I think I do. I certainly started, like, when I grew up, I didn't want to be a comedian. You know, I didn't even occur to me. I don't know the first thing about it. I wanted to be an artist. Since the age of 10, I was drawing all the time. You know. And grew up and went to art college, and that was all I wanted to be. And then when I started to go to college, I got into a band and started to enjoy the performance angle of it.
What sort of band was it, and what did you play?
Oh, I mean, well, I don't even know. We were called... Well, we had a few incarnations. We were called Cup of Sunshine.
Okay, nice. This was the 90s.
Yeah, very nice. So it was very sort of Red Hot Chili Peppers, California, white boy funk kind of...
Yeah.
Well, we were good, you know. We were a really, really good, successful university band, and we did lots of good support with like, The Prodigy and Pop Willy itself, and lots of good people, like, you know, Galliano. So and we did a lot of festivals, and we were decent, you know what I mean? I mean, up to a point.
What was your role in the band?
I was the drummer, and then I played the bass, and I did sort of singing / rapping in, and I turn that in the loosest possible sense.
Does any of this exist in recorded media?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
And it remain in that vault somewhere.
Okay, fine. Publicly available. Fair enough.
But I always wrote the lyrics, and I've always written, and even within my art, when I was doing visual art, I used the written word as well, both as narrative and decoratively. You know, in a way that graffiti does. I was very inspired by graffiti, and I was very inspired by sort of primitive art, or so-called primitive art, outsider art. I don't. Is that a term you know?
I understand outsider art to mean stuff that doesn't sell for any money, but it's art as cult, as kind of like a tool for people to use rather than an artifact necessarily to be admired in a gallery.
Okay, well, actually...
Is that wrong?
I think the term technically means, I mean, I guess it's a loose definition, but it's often used on people who have been in mental institutions.
Okay.
So they use it to express themselves.
Gotcha.
But it is indeed that, not sold. But now it's become very culty and then championed by a few well-known artists, like contemporarily, De Buffet being one of them, Picasso was another one.
Mm.
A lot of those abstract expressionists who were looking for quite childlike things, they then really championed these outsider artists who were literally locked up in an asylum asylums, doing it as a kind of craft club thing. And then, you know, as is the way of the world, they started selling big bucks and actually starting to actually, you know, it became its own ism and genre. But initially it was it was exactly that. It was sort of crafty, really. But they would, there'd be a lot of, and it didn't conform to that kind of classical norm of what you should do. So that, you know, people just fucking did what they wanted, you know. So there were a lot of writing on stuff, and I really liked this use of, as I say, using words as narrative and using words as decoration. It just looked nice as a pattern.
Is there, and this might be a completely, this might be a red herring, but I know your dad was a vicar.
Mm.
And that makes me, when I think of kind of the word being decorative, it makes me think of biblical kind of
those illuminated scriptures.
Was that something that you were exposed to
absolutely,
as a kid? Was
absolutely. I mean, I would say that my father is the reason I learned to draw, because he taught RE. He was the chaplain in the school I was at, and he taught RE by getting us to draw cartoons of the scriptures. So rather than it being, or as he saw it anyway, rather than it being sort of rather dry, just sort of text-based stuff and him banging on from the Bible, he sort of made us go and make a cartoon out of that. And I just, I suspect if I'm junior psyching myself, I did it to please my father, tried to do that really well, and I did it because I actually enjoyed art. And those are probably one and the same thing, perhaps. Certainly at that point in my life, anyway.
You mean, what, two things were the same?
Of learning to draw because I enjoyed it, and learning to draw because I pleased my father. Because
sure,
my father,
okay.
Mine and my father's relationship has always been relatively volatile. That might be my own red herring, but I sort of think if I'm looking at it and doing a junior psych, that might be the case, you know? So I learnt to draw by doing these cartoons of the scriptures. So, you know, make of that what you will, for a 14-year-old boy, a very God-fearing boy, you know.
Were you?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of, whenever I hear vicar, I always think gentle Church of England, not necessarily hell-related.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right? Absolutely much more that that sort of Church of England cucumber sandwiches aspect of it.
Okay.
So he...
What's the relationship between that and you being God-fearing?
Well, because I grew up believing in God. I grew up... I think I was about 16 before I realised that not everyone's father was a vicar. You know, it just sort of didn't occur to me. So it's so much part of my... And then when I sort of started questioning it at that sort of 15, 16 age, and I'm confirmed and all that sort of business, I absolutely had a relationship with God. I can remember having that relationship with God, you know, as a person, as much as one wants to sort of label him like that, praying to him, talking to him, often at conflict with him, but definitely he existed in my life, and I had to deconstruct him to the point that now, as an adult, he no longer exists, but I remember him. And so I was just very... And it isn't that my father was overly kind of hell and brimstone. He was more, you know, as you rightly pointed out, Church of England, nicely. I think the assumption amongst my siblings and was that God exists. God is the word. And, you know, I didn't question that. Or when I started questioning it, anyway, I questioned it from the point of like belligerence and being wrong and being in some way morally destitute.
It must be a very complex relationship to have with your dad if it's volatile to begin with, just presumably just because of personality and because you're a boy and he's your dad.
Yes,
and
yes.
Hence, you know, struggle. But for him to be the representative of God on earth, for you to presumably, I mean, I remember when I don't think I ever really had faith. I remember being about 11 and kind of going, "Oh, this isn't real, is it?" Like, do you know what I mean? And because it was the God in my life was, or the religion in my life was applied by a school which I didn't like and resented. It was only at for a few years, and over that time, very quickly went, "Wait a minute." For me, it was sort of it had no relationship to my family.
Yeah.
It was me just going, there's a thing that I go away from my family to this school. There are religious-y type stuff. And I had an awakening where I kind of risked opening my eyes during the Lord's Prayer and went, Oh, I thought I was going to get hit by lightning. Oh, wait a minute. None of it's real, But I had a lot of resentment for my, up until my kind of 20s when I finally got over myself. I was very like, hey, man, this is a cult. This is bullshit. You know, I had like a sort of a certain amount of testosterone-fueled resentment about having been lied to.
Mm. And by whom? Even... By your parents? Were they?
No, they weren't. They didn't go to Tosso. But a sort of, I suppose I used that as one of the things. I resented my school, they were like the totem of school is lying to me, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Via religion, man.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
but what I mean is that is a comparatively simple thing.
Well, this is an institution outside of you, I think. Whereas
absolutely
that you
right.
can choose. It's a bit like, you know, maybe it's like the police. You can choose to resent the police. You can choose to pick up bits of the police that you think, oh, that's quite valid.
Sure.
And then you can choose to sort of go, well, have a healthy disrespect for the police because it's an institution and outside of you. But the trouble is, as you're pointing out, you know, it's part of my DNA and I had to kill it. You know what I mean? I can't just sort of go, well, I'm not going over there again. I'll choose to visit another place. I had to cut that limb of me off because it was part of my DNA.
And did you, what was your dad's reaction to that?
Well, it's interesting actually, because I think my sister still goes to church. My brother goes to church, but I think really because he wanted to get his kids into good schools. And my other sister was never been a believer and sort of never really, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but has never been a sort of deep thinker. So she's just sort of like,
sure.
And although I'm the sort of confirmed atheist and the badge-wearing atheist, I would say, and I think he would agree with me, I am the most religious of his children. I still would say I'm very religious. My terminology and language is very religious. I would often, he'd be like, God bless you. You know, so much of my turns of phrase are religious. My interests are quite religious. I'm still very interested in it, you know, and how it pertains to people's behaviour now.
So that's it. So you're not the most believingest of his children.
But I'm the most interested in religion. And he says I have the most conversations with him. He has the most conversations with me about religion. And I'm questioning it more with an intelligence. So I think in that sense, I think he accepts that. I think it's a sorrow for him, but we converse. And I think, you know, I've done a couple of shows on religion, Edinburgh shows, where he became my, it's quite handy actually, you know, became my handy sort of consultant if I'm trying to remember. So that bit, you know, so where was it that Jesus said, you know, get behind me, Satan, and he'll go, well, that was in the wilderness. I go, thank you. You know what I mean? Like, and of course one has Wikipedia for that now, but like, you know, back in the day. So I would, he was my go-to for religious conversation and religious knowledge and religious information.
Do you feel, we mentioned outsider art, and I just want to stay with that word for a second. Did you feel, do you, or have you felt like an outsider to society, to religion?
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I think I've always been an outsider. I went to public school, but I'm not wealthy. My father was the chaplain, so we got in on scholarships. I got on an art scholarship, so I was an outsider in that respect. All my friends, you know, were minted. You know, my best friend had a Picasso in his bedroom. You know, so you've got
Jesus,
this really
no,
weird. Yeah. I mean, you know, crazy stuff. You know,
one of those ones on a napkin that get a cocktail
and a Warhol,
a proper one.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Right,
proper one,
right. I didn't know anyone.
No, because it's ludicrous. and again, you know, it's sort of one only. That was my norm as well. So it's only once you leave that institution that you realise, oh, not everybody's friends have got Picassos in there, you know, or have got Ferraris, or have got like these are very well. I mean, public, you know, I mean, not all people at public school were like that.
Sure.
Some people are quite normal, but they're all wealthy. But some people are super, super wealthy. So I felt the odd one out there. I felt the odd one out and perhaps my family, because I'm the most artistic, when my brothers and sisters are more, well, they're not creatives in that sense. Mm. So I think I felt an outsider in my own family, and I think being an atheist in that family as well, sort of a bit later on, always made me feel, I always felt at odds with. I think I got reviewed by someone who I can't remember, saying he is a man at odds with the universe, and I remember thinking that is absolutely spot on. And my father saying, "Oh, I read a review about you," and that is absolutely spot on. And I think that's sort of I think that might be the true of any creative. I think that might be, you know, too, you need that slightly looking outside, being outside rather, and looking in at society.
And how much is that outsider quality a choice, and how much is, like, how much of it is deliberate, like as a resistance to something, and how much of it is simply who you were just born as?
Mm. Well, I don't know that. I mean, that's a big nature nurture debate, I think, probably, isn't it? I feel that's just who I have been naturally, though I have continued to make choices that keep that slightly outsider view. You know, I think I'm still, I mean, I'm not an angry young man anymore. I'm an angry middle-aged man now, you know. And I feel like I'm not as angry as I was, and that I might have choice over, I certainly had no choice over how angry I was as a kid. It wouldn't be a case of going, I'll just drop that. I'm chemically, you know, angry. I don't think I'm that now. I think I can make the decision to be quite benign and less angry, but I kind of want to be angry because it still defines who I am. So I'm hanging on to that. I don't want to be like those plebs.
You mean your family specifically?
No, I mean like everybody.
Everyone else, like, yeah, the insiders. Yeah.
Can I swear?
Of course.
Yeah, there's a great... a phrase from Johnny Rotten, John Lydon. He goes, I've met the man in the street and he's a cunt. and I rather kind of but now I it amuses me, that stance, you know what I mean? And I'm nowhere near as chip on my shoulder as I was, and I'm angry, but I'm not sort of, I'm much more benign than I was, but
what was the chip on your shoulder?
I think going back, I think maybe the chip was like being having no money in a scenario where people had loads of money. I think that if I look back at it, I find that quite challenging. Oh, the other thing, of course, is being taught in a school, being at the school that your father's at, is quite a peculiar. You know, that's quite a, you know, most people. I mean, the headmaster's son was in the same class as me, and he was a total fuck up. And, you know, and I kind of kept
Did
it
you
together.
Get on?
Yeah, you know, because I think we related to each other, because it's a bad situation to be in, to be at the school that your, you know, parents are at. There's no, and I lived on it, you know, so I lived, we went to school 6 days a week, but then there was chapel on Sunday. I lived on the school because the chaplaincy was in school. So it was like my absolute complete world, you know. But then not having all the trappings of that wealth. And I've, you know, I've grown up to kind of go see that's not all it's made out to be. But I definitely felt angry about that. And that's no one's fault but my own. But,
is there, it strikes me that the identity of an artist might be quite a powerful way of, like an empowering way to deal with not having much money.
Well, it's very romantic, yes.
Like if you don't have much money when you're a kid, when you're a teenager,
yeah.
If you've decided to be an artist, then maybe that aligns with, hey, I don't need money, guys.
Yes, perhaps it does. Yeah, that's interesting. I never really thought of it like that. Yeah. Well, there is that sort of romantic, sort of starving in the garret kind of notion, which is a notion I never adhered to, because I thought...
We had loads of food.
Well, no, but I felt... I mean, this is one of the things that really attracted me to stand-up going forward a few years, was, you know, I identified at an early age, I wanted to be an artist. Then I, you know, a catch all of I wanted to be a creative, live a creative life. And then, but then, you know, literally not being able to sell a painting or get anywhere with that kind of scenario. Same with the band, particularly, we didn't get any money from doing that. And then people were going, oh, there's, you can get paid for doing gigs. And I thought, well, I'm, you know, I work really hard. I'm not poor because I'm indolent. I'm poor because there's no money in this notion of artists shouldn't get paid, you know? And like if, why shouldn't I get, you know, if I used my, I'm a smart dude who went to a very good school. You know, 100 years ago, I'd have been running Singapore. You know what I mean? You know, if I'd chosen to do that route of going into the military or going into the city, which was the routes for people, you know, and I, no disrespect to the people I was at school with, but less able than me. Doing who I've run into these days, and you know, from a material point of view, just sort of live very well, and that's not to sort of go that they haven't worked for that, and they aren't smart people, they are, but like, you know, I haven't sat on my ass, and that's why I'm kind of I mean, it sounds very Thatcherite, but like kind of like, you know, the reason you're poor is because you sit around doing nothing, but I work really hard. So why shouldn't I make a living out of it? You know what I mean? So I felt like, and I'm not doing that. I don't understand the mechanisms of that within the art world. But comedy was like, no. If you work really hard, and back when we started, in the, you know, it really was a meritocracy. If you're good, and you work really hard, it will pay off because at that point it was a meritocracy.
We worked with Andrew O'Neill last night, the previous guest on the podcast, who had a very funny bit about the fact that he. When he started stand up, there was loads of money around, but he wasn't good enough to make it. And now he's good enough, and all the money's fucked off.
yeah, that's quite gauly.
We talked a little bit last night about the progression and the illusion of progression that the circuit creates. Mm. So, just in terms of what you're saying, when you arrive at stand up, when you bring yourself to stand up, and you're like, oh, actually, I can make money from this. Do you remember the first gig that you got paid for?
I don't. Well, see, now I'm missing a slight bit here of my life, which I think is pertinent. When the band I was in imploded, as the lyric writer, I ended up doing a lot of performance poetry and spoken word. So I did that for a few years, which I really enjoyed. And there was quite a I was living in Brighton. There was quite a burgeoning scene in Brighton, a do tongues scene. And then up here, when I moved to London,
sorry?
It was called do tongues. That was the sort of operation.
Yeah.
Who ran things in Brighton? It was quite a kind of good scene. And then I moved to London, and there was quite a good scene there as well. And it was whilst doing that that someone said, hey, you know, was actually the friend of my then, the mother of my child, Colette, who worked in comedy. And she said, I think you're really funny. You should be a comedian. And I was like, that was the first I'd ever thought. I'd never been to comedy. I've been to comedy once, you know. And I...
like a club?
Yeah, I went to the old comedy store and I saw, it was incredible. I saw Lee Evans in that. You know that, you know what the old comedy store is? It's now the
it
100 Club,
to be
isn't it?
Storm?
Not the 100 Club. It's Storm.
Yeah,
tiny room.
Yeah.
And Lee Evans, you know, just all that suction feet off the...
Sure,
it was incredible,
sure.
You know? Just I mean, you know, he's got the energy to fill the O2. Yeah. Imagine what he's like in a 100-seater room. It was unbelievable. But that was the only experience I've ever had of doing stand-up. And my thought was like, God, no, I don't want to do that. That's scary. You know, that's a whole different league. And then I sort of thought, when she entered me into So You Think You're Funny... So I was like, well, I don't want to be a bottler. I'll do it. It'll be awful. But at least I can hold my hand up and go, you know, I didn't bottle it. I did it. And I ended up getting into the final. So then when I got into Edinburgh, and then we were exposed to other comedians. And then there were other comedians who were starting to do performance poetry stuff as well. Anne Topolsky, Simon Munnery, Stuart Lee. So I met them and they're going, yeah, you can make a living out of this, you know. And I started to see, oh, maybe that's true. So to go back to your immediate question, I didn't never do stand-up and then do a stand-up gig.
Gotcha.
I'd already done some gigs, or lots of gigs rather, I've got on stage in a band since I was 16, and I've also did 2 or 3 years of performance poetry, which I got paid for. So I don't really remember. And then when I started doing stand-up as well, I would do a bit of poetry and a bit of stand-up. So I can't remember at what point there was no more poetry. It was just pure stand-up, for want of a better phrase, you know? I don't know when that was, and I don't know when that was that I then got paid for it.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So this is Marcus. I love talking to Marcus, and he's someone I know well enough to prod gently about his preconceptions of himself. It was interesting talking to him about anger and exactly, you know, the difference between the sort of low-level resentment anger that he might feel at the world and his use or not of that anger in his stand-up. Lots more excellent stuff to come, and of course, half an hour of extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. I tailed off there. I was about to reminisce about a gig we did once in Graz in Austria, which was the first gig I ever did abroad. And I remember eagerly listening to everything Marcus said in a very excitable kind of, who else was on that one? I just had a flash of the guy whose name I can't remember, but he's in Batman. You know, he's the comic who, when you were watching The Dark Knight, there's the scene on the ferry, and there's that comic. He's done movies. He's in a Jackie Chan movie. Told me a great anecdote about Jackie Chan, which I often pass off as my own. Can't remember his name. Email in if you know. this is only appropriate to circuit comics from the UK from around the end of the 2000s. What is that man's name? It's a very good comic. Anyway, it was the three of us. We were in Austria, and we had a lot of fun. But that was me deciding not to bore you all with that anecdote. Anyway, God, right. It's Monday morning, and I have got lots to do. More on that in a very short postamble. But that's all of that. As I said, Marcus is doing an Edinburgh show. We'll talk about that a little bit at the end, but also check the show notes, get a link and get a ticket to that, or to simply turn up if he's on the free fringe, or one of them, I think he might be. And you can also see my work in progress show Primer, which is which I'm twiddling the poster as we speak. One of the many, many things to do as we enter June. And for once this year, I'm not white knuckling it, because it is a work in progress. And the point of it is I'm going to write it all morning, do it at 3 o'clock every day, and then be at the festival, and then rewrite it the following morning. And hopefully it will change and develop throughout the festival. So I'm really looking forward to that. But there is an extent to which I don't have the fear of, oh, God, it's got to be perfect. I have the fear of, oh, God, it has to exist and continue to existing. And I have to kind of climb the hill every time, as opposed to the regular festival, where once you've got your eye in over the first couple of days, you're like, that's the show. It works. Let's do it. This one, I've sort of compressed a year's worth of work into a few hours every morning of August. It's going to be fun either way. Listen, I'll chat to you more at the end. Let's get back to Marcus Birdman.
You're not an angry stand-up. Like, it would seem to me like stand-up is a big outlet for emotion, but I don't... If you're someone who kind of feels like you have an angry... a chemical anger, I might presume that would come out on stage somehow, but it doesn't. It doesn't particularly.
Well, it doesn't because it doesn't work. I've tried... I've tried to do it, and I sound... angry. Funny that, isn't it? I sound overly earnest, overly tub thumping, and you know, I think I feel, and I've always felt, you know, I feel less like this now. And we had this conversation yesterday. But I care a lot less about how anything works these days. Just, you know, leave me alone. But I certainly screw up and started doing stand-up in that kind of, if everybody would shut up and listen to me, the world would be a better place. I got the answers. And I, you know, wanted to do stand-up like that, I think. You know, sort of, I think I wanted to do artwork like that. And one of my frustrations with the artwork and why I sort of abandoned it for a while was I felt it was too esoteric, unable to express, it didn't express itself very well. It has a very much, I mean, indeed, I feel like it has a, it deliberately obfuscates its own message so that it's like, if you need to ask, you'll never know type thing. And one of the things I like about stand-up is it's very direct. It's like rap. It's informative. It tells you what that person is thinking in a very it doesn't emote. It's not poetry. It's not lyrics. It's not painting.
Necessarily any subtext.
No, it's text. It has to hit your cranium at exactly the same speed as it will be understood, and it is being said in real time. One doesn't muse over it. It is information about one's stance. And I found that if I've used it to fully express that aspect of me, the angry side of me, I just sound tub thumping and it doesn't work. I don't know why it doesn't work. I've tried it because I wish I could be more issue based, but I find it's just, maybe it's because I am, you know, my default setting is to be a little bit angry and a bit spiky. And so I need to slightly dress up. I need to find the other, I need, that's not all of me. I am also a delightful human being, as you pointed out, and a warm person. And I think I think I am friendly as well. I'm not sort of, you know, I've been disingenuous to myself. I can be incredibly spiky, but I like people and I like socialising into. Well, actually, I don't like socialising as much as I like having one-on-one conversations. And I think I'm benevolent of spirit, but that's the bit of me that I think works on stage. Not the. Why don't you wanker shut up, fuck up, and listen to me? I've got all the answers. You're a pack of cunts. Funny that, isn't it? Funny how that doesn't work.
But some people do make that work. Don't they?
They do. I agree, and I admire that. But I can't make it work. You are the player you are, aren't you? You can work on your backhand or whatever it is, but if your forehand's stronger, then you use your forehand more, don't you? And I guess that's that you follow the line of least resistance, maybe in your, or at least I do in my stand-up. I mean, stand-up's hard enough already without abandoning the bits you're best at and doing some of the bits that you're worst at, right?
What do you think are the bits you're best at?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that.
What were they in the early days? What's the bit? What was the first kind of note that you struck that you went, oh, hang on, this works. This is a vein.
I don't know if anyone would agree with this, but personally,
doesn't matter. This is your time.
I think language and rhythm of what I say.
Very good. Let the record show I pointed at Marcus as if to say, I agree with that. Yes, that's good.
Do you agree with that with me? Or do you agree with that with a comedian?
100%.
So I think there's a flow, which I think probably comes from lyric writing, comes from poetry, comes from doing rapping, he says in inverted commas. But I think I enjoy language and I enjoy the meter as much as the content. So almost the medium's the message in one sense.
I believe this will be something like episode 293, and I think we've never used the word meter before.
Right.
And I think that's...
Really?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. But I can see the... I can hear in my head like the echoes of the rhythm of some of your bits that I know very well. Some of we've gigged together numerous times over a long period, and some of your bits I know very well, and already I can go, yes, of course. That, I mean, the bit we talked about that you no longer do, the goose stepping bit. Should we fill in any context on that? Let's just leave it. But the, you know, the rhythm of that bit is absolutely the bones of the bit.
Yeah.
The bones of the bit are in the rhythm. It's a funny idea. And let's use one that we can talk about. Do you have like a mainstay, something that you used last night? Here we are in Liverpool. We both did a bunch of shows, whatever the double of a brace is of shows last night for Hot Water. And fantastic shows, energetic rooms, great.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Can you think of a mainstay, something that you did in every gig last night, which is... Or I'll tell you, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
One of your... I think of it as one of your best jokes, and one of your singular, the ones I remember most, the joke about being in the bath and knowing that the mums are going to hear about... You know what I mean? Would you mind just doing that bit? Because, I mean, I'll butcher it now, and I'm happy to do that. I don't want to make you do some stuff.
do some stuff.
just so I can listen to the rhythm.
Okay, so... I can't even remember how it begins.
It's completely weird out of context. I appreciate that. And if this bombs and is crap, we'll just take it out. It's fine. But I feel like there's something to be said for the rhythm of that bit.
God, how does it start? It's really weird.
I suppose the punchline comes quite a long way after the start, doesn't it? It's not a short bit. There's a better bit.
I can't remember exactly how it starts, so if I'm fumbling through it. But I was in the bath, and my daughter, who was 5 at the time, walks in, points between my legs and says, "Daddy, what's that?" This is a bad situation for a man to be in, because, you know, whatever it is you say, she's going to go straight back to a school, tell all her friends, they're going to tell their teachers, they're going to tell their parents, and everybody's going to know exactly what it was that her dad said. So I thought about this very carefully and said, that is massive.
Yeah, I mean, that is, it's a fantastic, obviously under-delivered, you know, presented there, of course, but the rhythm, that is the rhythm. That, exactly.
Isn't it?
It's that like rhythm, it's like a meter of that is perfect.
Where it rhymed, it's... He says affectatiously, it's rapping, isn't it? It's bum 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 bum. You know, and I definitely because I drummed, because I think that's it's key to me, and I don't really look to comedians for inspiration. I look to music. You know, I would always put music on more than, and I don't know people's specials and stuff because I don't really. Well, I don't have a huge fascination with stand-up. I have a fascination with lyrics. I have a fascination with... I listen to a lot of rap. I listen to a lot of reggae, which, again, is, you know, that same sort of information and rhythm and meter. And I think I started my career as I wanted to... Do you know Main Offender by The Hives?
Yes, of course, it's like really high
energy, you know. And it's like, it's not very complex, it's just fast and furious and bang bang bang, and it starts at 1,000 miles an hour and ends at 1,000 mile and doesn't piss about, you know. I wanted to ape that as a stand-up. You know, I want
consciously. I'm
going to do what the Hives do, comedically. I'm going to do it at 1,000 miles an hour. I'm going to do it like I'm a heavyweight boxer punching people out, and I'm going to leave no gaps, and I'm going to leave no sort of speaker unburnt. It's just, you know, and there's just, you can like it or you can not like it, but boy, he gave us both barrels there, you know. I mean, I've stepped off that a bit, but because I think you can hide behind that. Well, I hid behind that, but I think essentially club comedy, it was in my interest to do so, to just be bam bam bang, and also I liked that energy and that rhythm.
And precision as well.
And precision, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Does the precision, does the meter that we were talking about, does that mean that you stick very close to a script?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very scripted. I mean, I write it all.
Do you? You write it all out?
I write it all out.
What point in the process? Like, from go, you write the sentence and then you learn it and then you deliver it.
Yeah.
And then do you iterate it?
Once it's sort of up and running, and then it gets moved around. Like, I think I stop... If I've been doing a piece for maybe, I don't know, a year or whatever, if I went back to the script that I've wrote a year ago, I bet you it changed an awful lot. Almost unconsciously, perhaps. But I start off with writing and chopping out bits, just literally chopping out any extraneous bits, even the word. You know, even I want 3 syllables here, not, and I've got 5. What word can I chop out, you know? Even if it's "and" or "the," I chop them out, you know, so it has this rhythm.
Okay.
Because I can, I feel like I'm doing it like a drum, you know, I'm doing it like a rapper.
And do you improvise on stage ever?
Yeah, but not really with my material. I'll abandon the material to sort of gas on a bit. But, you know, or if something comes up at me, I will. But I'm not. I'm not very secure in doing it. Sometimes I can do it, and I just go, God, I was really good at that. And sometimes it's just a dog's dinner. And so I feel like I don't try and do it unless I'm A, emceeing, or B, you know, I interrupted. Then I will use it. I think it's a good limb to sort of stretch, but I don't go there immediately. I have songs that I've written that are precise with the exact timings and bridges, sure, and chorus with the exact harmonies in place. I want to deliver those. I'm not going to piss.
Metaphorically in terms of stand-up.
Yes, like, yeah, exactly. You know, I've taken great bones to make sure that the sound's right on the drum, in relationship to the horn section. So I'm not going to fuck about with it when I then got on stage.
You'll do some inter-song banter.
Banter. Yeah, yes, okay. Yes, exactly. Or I might slightly extend the sax solo.
I love it.
But essentially, yeah, it's like I've written a song, I've laboured over the song, I want to deliver the song. I think that's why I get really furious when people interrupt me.
I've seen that happen.
Yeah, it just pisses me off. I mean, the whole aspect of that, you know, when a stand-up being something that is okay to interrupt infuriates me. People's, you know, it's one of those things that, yeah, and then you've had this when you meet people socially and you tell them they're a comedian. I'm like, mate, I mean, respect, couldn't, you know, hardest game in the world, right? But utter respect. And that doesn't seem to translate for when you're standing in front of them, of how badly people behave and how badly people don't respect you when you're on stage. There's no respect, you know. So, and I don't want to be humorless about it, and I understand it's not a play, and it's not a, you know, it's not a monologue. There is back and forth, but that should be done within the realms of good, bad, and decent behaviour, not just drunk. You know, I hate this aspect of, like, it, to me, it's an art form, and I don't consider that. I say that with no apology. You know, it's an art form like poetry is, or jazz is, or music is, or dance is. Stop fucking interrupting me. Ask me a question, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To say I don't agree with what you just said, or get involved, but don't interrupt me. We don't interrupt the theatre. You're thrown out.
Is that at odds with the mainstay of your work as a road act, as a club act?
Yeah, it's really difficult.
Yeah.
You get interrupted all the time. Yeah, it's really difficult.
Is there a solution to that? Is there, because, like, if you could do your own tour shows, have you toured?
Not really, a little bit, but not really. I mean, I did. I did a double header with Paul Sinner, which was, you know, an own tour, and that's really about it. I've done some, you know, individual festivals and stuff like that, but not touring. No, so I don't know whether that would work for me. I'm not for want of trying. I just haven't managed to get into that league. Whether that would be an improvement. I mean, I think I like theatre gigs for that reason, that people do tend to behave better. But I also miss that. I mean, I think that's, again, it comes to this, I'm a contrary fellow, is that on the one hand, I'm saying all of what you said, but also I do enjoy rolling my sleeves up and having a good old ding-dong at some prick in the front row. You know? So, but I, some, like, last night...
I mean, it's the gunslinger, right?
Yeah, a little
bit.
Sometimes
you've got to shoot
someone.
You've
got to kill someone. Yeah. I don't want to. I'd like to sell this like gentlemen. But it's... I said it to Danny last night about that. I did the last gig, and by that point, it was quite beery and boozy. And they were nice, but I had to alpha male it. And... Yeah. I don't like alpha mailing it, because it pushes me and it pushes my material into a realm that makes it totally different. because I think I am quite funar and a bit like lewd and crude and sort of like the Derek Vickers son.
I'm not going to translate the term finar. That's, you either know it or you
don't. You either know it. If you need to ask, you'll never know. But that's sort of, but I feel like I'm the sort of carry on cartoon finar aspect of sort of filthy dirty jokes, blue jokes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the kind of the alpha male, laddie, disrespectful. But I find that some, if you have an audience who are a bit leery, I push it into that realm for self-preservation. I find that if especially if you've got to close gigs and the headliner has often got to do a job to do, and it's, they've got more unruly and one has to close out the set and one has to sometimes whack people over the head. And so I become more alpha male. I wish I didn't. I wish I had the courage to be more me, which I think is not alpha male, or at least a nicer than that sort of slightly wham bam. So I put on that gladiator's hat to finish the job, and it's slightly a hat that doesn't fit me. I can wear it, and I think I can wear it quite well, but I don't want to, and I'd rather leave it. I'd rather leave it off and be more vulnerable, because I like myself on stage in that environment where I'm being vulnerable and the audience are allowing me to be vulnerable. Like, I've got a load of stuff about stroke, my stroke, which I don't know if you've ever seen, which I will do rarely in a club, because if it gets some dissent, I am so furious. Because it's like, how dare you? You know what I mean? If I'm talking about,
I've seen the gear about like thinking it was a hangover. Very accessible stuff.
It's very accessible stuff. You know, I mean, it's stand up, so it's like it's not you know, complex stuff. But it's still, I'm bearing my soul, you know, and showing the weakness and being vulnerable and going to something very dear to me. You know, if someone interrupts me and I'm doing a dick joke, I don't really care, because I'm not really invested in that in a sort of personal way. But if I'm talking about, well, you know, the third sort of CAT scan I've had, and some wanker pipes up, I feel betrayed, and I feel sort of violated. So it will infuriate me. So going back to this the early point of what I was saying about, you know, I wish people didn't interrupt, because it's an awful.
Do you? We'll come on to the stroke because I'm interested in that. Maybe we should. Let's talk about that now. You were 40.
Yeah.
And you had a stroke in your sleep.
Yep.
And you lost a quarter of your eyesight.
Yes.
I remember.
Yes.
I think it's the like bottom left.
It is the bottom right, actually.
It's the bottom right. There you go.
Yeah, all correct.
I've been on one of your. We had drinks, didn't we, in New Zealand on tour?
Yes, yes.
We had stroke day.
Well, it's become
the stroke club.
The stroke club. It's become. We drank ourselves to a point where it was worse than my stroke. what was that? New Plymouth, wasn't it?
New Plymouth.
Wow, we all felt awful. Acaster, you
and Birdie.
Yeah.
Gleeson.
Yeah. Yes, that's become my unofficial birthday. I was 40. I woke up. I couldn't see properly. I mean, I make a joke out of this, but I thought I was partly hungover and just exhausted. And didn't do anything about the fact that I couldn't see properly for a couple of days, and then went to get my eyes tested. A
couple of days.
Yeah. I just thought it would clear up. And
There's Australian men listening to this thinking, legend.
Well, it's interesting, actually, Stuart, because I used to be a massive hypochondriac. And I think until the point when something quite serious happened to me, I don't think I am anymore. Which is a quite weird thing, isn't it? When nothing had happened to me, I was full of the...
Did you meet a genie and make some sort of wish to end hypochondria and then you were the victim of classic ironic switcheroo?
Yeah, switcheroo. I was just like, oh, it'll be all right. I don't know what that's, you know. And I'm thinking, oh... And it kind of coincided that a very good friend of mine father-in-law had a stroke. He had an aneurysm in his head at exactly the same time. And then I was convinced that he had a brain tumour. I was convinced this is what had happened to me. And I was like, I'm not thinking about this. I don't want to, I'm burying my head in the sand. And then it's like, it'll go away. And then after 2 days, it hadn't gone away. So I'm like, oh God, I've got to go to... So I didn't go to a hospital. I went to an optician to have my eyes tested, who said, I don't want to alarm you, but go to hospital now. You know? Which is a phrase that doesn't alarm anyone. You know? So I went to, had a brain scan, and...
Yeah. Was there, when you walked into hospital, was there a kind of... was there an emergency feel to it? Did they rush you into a brain scan?
No, I can't remember now. I went to the NHS and they said you need a brain scan, and I should have lied and said I can't see, because I said I can't see very well, and I should have been a bit more insistent.
Yeah.
They put me a scan in for a month's time or something, you know. And so I went private. That's what I did. So I went private and had a scan. I think the next day, and got the results back. And he said, and again, it's kind of funny in retrospect, because I convinced myself in that interim, what that was now about a week, that I'd got a brain tumour. And it was curtains, and he said to me, "You've had a stroke." And I remember saying, "Thank fuck for that."
Yeah.
You know, and sort of out loud, and he was a bit, this guy's insane. You know, so, but I think it was, it became, and he said, "It's not going to get any worse, it's not going to get any better." So I sort of thought, well, oh, that's better than a brain tumour. You know, so I'd had the stroke. I didn't experience having the stroke because I was asleep. I felt bloody awful. I felt like a really bad hangover. I was really tired and I couldn't see, but I didn't experience having it. So really all the trauma came subsequently was going to hospital for about 3 or 4 months, sort of twice a week to have, you know, a brain scan, a CAT scan, having my blood tested, having to swallow a camera, having being prodded here, hither and thither, being injected with radioactive dye. Because each time I went, I felt like I was playing Russian roulette. Like, this was the time the result's going to come out. They're going to tell me I've got leukemia, or I've got HIV, or I've got a brain tumour, or I've got lupus or some rare tropical disease, you know. And each time they went, no, it's completely benign, you know. And so... each time I went, I was like, I just played Russian roulette again. I'm fine. And there are a few things. I got a hole in my heart and a cyst on my brain. But so there were some things.
Okay, those are things you discovered.
I was born with them. Yeah. And
you discovered during the CAT scans.
Yeah,
That you had been born with them.
Yeah. You can actually feel it's got a lump on the side of my head. You can. No, it's massive. It's about the size of an egg. And because I looked at the, he you want to look at that? And he went, that's a cyst. And you know. What? And he went, it's totally benign. And I'm like, how can it be? It's massive. It's literally, honestly, so you can feel the side of my head there.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's like a lump, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's sort of that's it. That's the indentation, and that's the thing.
So
there's a lump.
But it's benign, and I have a hole in my heart, and that's what they think caused the stroke. But then, again, at that point, again, while I was going, so this is a heart problem, not a brain problem, and heart problems are, you know, it's a plumbing job. They know everything about a heart. I mean, they know absolutely everything about a heart, okay. And they know next to nothing about brains. So okay. You do not want a brain problem.
Sure.
You want a heart problem. Sure. If one is to have one. But it is, essentially, you know, yes, what I mean? Course, like, sure. So it was all, that was all... as I say, all the kind of stress came subsequently, really, and it wasn't a bad stroke. And you know, my eyesight isn't any better, but it's not terrible.
And you can still draw.
Yeah,
because that's the other one. Like one of the biggest strokes, you can lose your speech.
Absolutely.
And
well, you can lose your total art. You can lose your eyesight. You could lose like, and your speech, and of course, motor skills. So that, I mean, you know, Absolutely, you know, and with during my sort of visits to the stroke unit and whatnot, that they I met people in terrible conditions, you know. I mean, the never for the grace of God. So I was very lucky in one sense. I mean, would have been luckier not to have had it at all, I suppose.
I've got a couple of listener questions for you. One is from a listener called Scott, who says, when can Nicholas Blanks, age 10, colour in the ceiling of the classic comedy club?
Well, I mean, whenever he likes, it's not... It belongs to him.
That's that angle, dude. We hadn't focused too much on when you started to combine your art with the stand-up, which, I mean, the first one of those I saw was Grim Realities.
Yes.
Where you really... That wasn't animation, that was cartoons. And then later you did show it was animation, which I hadn't seen.
Which I'll never do again.
Will you? Oh, well, labour-intensive.
It's so labour-intensive.
Yeah, sure. Have a word with Howard.
No.
You want to do that?
I wish I'd listened to him a bit closer.
Yeah.
So yes, I did. At some point, I abandoned artwork for stand-up. I abandoned everything for stand-up because I was like, I'm so full on into this and it's so all-consuming that I didn't do anything else creative for about 10 years. And then sort of went, I kind of miss drawing, you know, and I started doing a bit of life drawing and kind of, and then drawing a few funny things. And then I just sort of had it in, just would do it in a club sets, have a little thing, drawing pad or some imagery or something. And, thought I wanted to, I miss it, and also I'm missing a trick here, you know, of combining the two. And then taking that one stage further of how to draw funny, which I've sort of, well, I'm an absolute toddler when it comes to that, but I've, rather than drawing to illustrate just sort of accurately, just sort of go, can I actually improve this? Is it in and of itself funny as an image?
That's really, that is not something I've ever considered.
No, I mean, neither really, except for, because I was never a big sort of cartoon fan or kind of, I'm a bit, I mean, I loved Asterix, I loved Tintin, but I wasn't like Beano or, you know, wasn't. And of course, they draw funny. You know, that's just visually there's caricature and extended noses or hands or the kind of perspective on certain things. You know, a huge hammer or whatever.
Sure.
Where people, you just look at it.
Or to draw a funny expression.
Yeah, funny expression
on an animal. Or looking with a really an expression where you know what he's feeling.
Or just. The picture's funny. There's no words, you know. Yeah. So it says it. There's one wonderful one where there's two scientists looking at a nuclear bomb, and they've got the white lab coats on, and so one's got his head in the thing, and there's another one behind him with a paper bag, and he's going about to smash his paper bag so it blows up.
The Far Side, right?
Is it? I can't remember who it is. But I just thought it was wonderful that you could tell a joke.
Yeah.
With a drawing, you know, rather than like it being an illustration of the joke. Which is what I did with Grim Realities.
Yes. You'd have the existing joke here's a version of it.
Here's an illustration of that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, can I do it the other way around? Can it be funny first or outside of the narrative, the actual written joke, the spoken joke. So that's something that I'm trying to work on. I don't know how successful I'm being at that.
And how? What's the work of that? How can you improve that?
I don't know.
New project, right?
What has been quite nice with my artwork to come back to it is to sort of learn a thing, to sort of use it as. It's a bit like I've sort of gone, right, this show, I'm going to play the bassoon in it, and I'm going to learn how to play the bassoon. So that was my first sort of, I'm going to learn how to cartoon to illustrate. Because I grew up in a bit, my artwork had been quite classical and then very graffiti based and stuff like that. And I wasn't an illustrator as such. So I sort of learned how to illustrate. How far I've got down that road, I don't know. Not for me to say. But I sort of used it as an opportunity and an excuse to learn how to do it because there was a reason for doing it. The next show, I wanted to learn how to animate. So I'd never animated before. So I learned some programs and worked on that and looked at various videos and a lot of other animations and to see how stop animation done, what the actual technical skills involved of what you've got to do as a process. And learnt it like that. So I've learned on the job, as it were. This time I'm doing it purely in Photoshop, and so I'm not actually drawing anything with a pencil.
Okay.
Because I want to learn Photoshop better. Hitherto, there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. For this year?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What's the show this year? What's it called?
It is called Last White Christmas. And it is the kind, I don't want to give the reveal away, okay. But it is a combination of Red Riding Hood and the Nativity play.
Okay.
So the Nativity play plays into my Christian background, obviously, of that aspect, and the Red Riding Hood and the Nativity thing deals with, I have a 14, soon to be 15 year old daughter who is discovering all the joys of teenage rebellion, sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And, the idea of telling a story where someone is mysteriously pregnant and has to deal with that and, oh, but God did it. I've found great favour with God and me being maybe rather suspicious of that. I think plays into my own narrative of a father, yes, with a teenage daughter. So that's...
And that kind of harks back to some of the themes of Grim Realities. It's like you've got certain preoccupations...
Yeah.
Do you think? Which kind of like, as that's what art is, isn't it? It's kind of one of the things that art is dealing with and translating and kind of pulling apart your preoccupations.
Yeah. Well, I like those. All of them have been based on, part one, the Nativity scene, notwithstanding, but have been grim fairy tales.
Yeah.
And I really like I liked firstly using sort of, I don't think I coined the term, but like that sort of kids' stories for adults. So it was like I used that sort of the look of kids' story, and I'd have like pull up bits that are opened up or popped down or whatever, in the very much the language of a child's book, which at that point I was kind of reading to my own daughter, but then make them adult in content so that rather than pulling down a thing and a snake kisses it, it says, fuck you or something, but using that kind of language, and also what I find attractive about the Grimm's fairy tales is that they're often or at least they were in the sort of pre-Disney, they were used to teach children the sort of adult world, adult theme, sex, drugs and violence and death and bad men in the woods and all that sort of thing, coming of age stuff. They were meant to be scary. They weren't meant to be the sort of saccharine, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs kind of thing as Disney made them. They were people, kids are getting their heads chopped off and eaten and that's that much more macabre, guts and stuff. And I've always found that pretty attractive.
And where is that?
How do you mean, sorry?
In Edinburgh.
Oh, sorry. It is at Banshee's Labyrinth 240 in the cinema room, which is quite handy because it's got a screen, so that's quite nice.
Are you happy?
Am I happy? No. I haven't been happy since 1986. but I'm not trying to be happy. I'm trying to be fulfilled and content. Happiness isn't my end game. And I don't mean that in a woe is me kind of way, because I'm creating something that makes me happy, so my intention is to try and create something. Being happy in and of itself, no.
I feel like I've got to ask some follow up to that to slightly get more to the bottom of that. So happiness isn't the end game. But being creative makes you happy, so you're being creative, presumably because on some level happiness is the end game?
No, not in order to be happy. I'm not doing it to be... I'm not creating to be happy. I'm creating because I feel the need to create. And if I do it well, or sort of... and well in inverted commas... that makes me happy as a byproduct. If it makes, or only makes me happy, it makes me content. It makes my it eases my heart.
Thanks, man.
So that was Marcus. Thank you very much to him for coming along and appearing on the show. A real pleasure to talk to him. Remember, 30 more minutes of Marcus talking about a little bit more on his stroke, a little bit more on a short, sharp strategy, shall we say, for overcoming writer's block and some other very interesting stuff indeed. So comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you'd like to access that and all the other extra stuff. So go and see Marcus. Come and see me doing Primer, the work in progress show at the Edinburgh Fringe. You can just go to edfringe.com and put our names in the search engine, or you can look, I mean, you can just Google it. You're a grown up. Or you can look in the show notes of this episode. That's the other thing. Next week, very excited to be bringing you an episode with Paul Smith. And the week after that, Nick Revel is now in the can. Nick Revel, 40 years or nearly 40 years in comedy with a 10-year gap in the middle. So we get like a perspective on how comedy changed over those 10 years when he was writing sitcoms, how the circuit changed, how the gigging circuit changed. It's like coring. It's like when you see a sort of polar expedition and they draw out a big core of ice and you can see all the strata. Fascinating chatting to Nick. The Paul Smith one is a joy and a revelation, as you might well expect. And I have some excellent guests in the diary, if not the can, coming up soon. So keep it ComCom. Thank you, as ever, to Nathan Wood for producing the show, to Rob Smouton for the music, who, if you're going to go to Glastonbury Festival, which is in a couple of weeks, then go and see Rob Smouton's band, Black Peaches. I believe they're opening the park stage at noon on the Sunday. So go along and wear your ComCom t-shirts and he'll clock you and perhaps wink at you from the stage. Rob Smouton is also in Hot Chip, but I don't know when their stage time is. Excellent, though they are. So thanks to Rob. Thanks to Jake Crossland for logging the show. Thanks to you for listening, sharing it, reviewing it on iTunes, particularly if you are... It's not called iTunes anymore. It's called Apple Podcasts. Apologies. But the web address still says iTunes. So there we are. But if you particularly are listening outside of the UK, then your reviews on whatever podcast app on which you are listening are all the more meaningful in getting a foothold in an even wider more global audience for this show. I think that's everything. Oh, I don't know if you're aware that Ellis James and John Robbins, having left Radio X, have moved to BBC 5 Live. I only just caught up with the first episode. I think it's 2 or 3 weeks old now. The first episode of their podcast, which, of course, they record the intro to the podcast just after coming off stage from their first ever live show, in which they're in a completely different environment on BBC. It is the fan base, the listener demographic is far wider and broader, and less necessarily tuned to them as people who built up a very specific fan base on Radio X and the ensuing podcast. And they are brilliantly, refreshingly, wonderfully, hilariously candid about the reaction to the show from the public. And you get to properly hear them shell-shocked. They left it in. They talk about it on the podcast. It's absolutely brilliant. And then they play you the show, which is excellent and really funny. So if you're a fan of Ellis and John, or you fall into any of the numerous self-named categories of retro wonders and so forth, and even if that means nothing to you, check out their podcast. I was crying with laughter as Ellis told John that he'd gone grey. It was really fun, and not just in a vicarious kind of their suffering way, although there is an element of that because they sort of wore it on their sleeve so proudly. But the show itself is also excellent, so don't miss that. Right, that concludes the podcast. Bye for now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.